Welcome to Meet the Writers. Today, I'm very excited to introduce you to a debut novelist. He grew up in Kentucky and has graduate degrees from Harvard and the Iowa Writers Workshop. He currently holds a fellowship at the University of Iowa. His book was on the LA Times bestseller list. It was a New York Times book review editor's choice. It's been called not only the great gay novel of our times, but also the first great novel of 2016. Garth Greenwell, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
What Belongs to You has had universally positive reviews. So just a sample, I don't want to embarrass you, but people need to get an idea of the reaction to this book. A rich, important debut, an instant classic to be savoured by all lovers of serious fiction. What Belongs to You is a great tragedy and Greenwell is a great writer. What Belongs to You is outstanding in just about every way a novel can be. And this masterfully told story seems certain to find a permanent place on the shelf of modern American classics. Well, the book is about to be published here in Britain, and no doubt similar reactions from this side of the Atlantic are about to drop. So, Garth, this is a very long way from Louisville.
It is a long way from Louisville, it's true.
Tell me about growing up gay in Kentucky in the 90s.
I mean, growing up gay in Kentucky in the 90s wasn't very easy. And I came out when I was 14 in a public school, which is something that, you know, when I was a high school teacher, I would have counseled a person like me away from doing. You know, to grow up a gay kid in Kentucky in the early 90s was to be taught one lesson about your life. And that lesson was that your life had no dignity and that it had no value. And, you know, this novel really came from the fact that teaching young people in Bulgaria in 2009 to 2013, I realized that that was exactly the lesson they had been taught as well.
Mm-hmm. So within your own life, I mean, you were a poet and you were then an opera singer.
Well, actually, I was an opera singer first. Music was really my introduction to the arts, and really music saved my life. I mean, when I was that 14-year-old kid, I came out when I was 14. My father kicked me out of the house. You know, I was in a really perilous place, like a lot of queer kids are, continue to be. And a high school choir teacher in Louisville, Kentucky, heard something in my voice and somehow found a generosity in himself and gave me free voice lessons after school. And then told me about a boarding school in northern Michigan for the arts and encouraged me to apply there. And when I was 16, I escaped Louisville. And went to the Interlochen Arts Academy, and for the first time was in a place where, one, it felt okay to be gay, and two, where, you know, people built their lives around a kind of passionate investment in the arts and in literature.
Mm-hmm. And poetry, of course, too, in your case. How allied are the rhythm of poetry and the rhythm of music, and do those both find a place in your prose?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, you know, it was as a singer that I first encountered poetry, and you know, my first training in literature was as a singer. And I think, you know, both operatic singing and lyric poetry encourage a particular relationship to language and a particular relationship to the sense of the physicality of words, and also to kind of the emotional potential of suspending language in time. And I think one reason I'm drawn to kind of the expansive potential of English syntax is because I have experience in those two arts.
Mm-hmm. Labels now, and they're never pleasant, but would you call yourself a gay writer?
Absolutely. Without question, without hesitation. And, you know, I understand why there are some writers who would resist that label. And I understand that for a long time, gay writers have been told a story that if they center their work on gay lives, and if they tell gay stories, and if they identify themselves as gay writers, they're closing themselves off from a certain kind of readership and from that, I think, very false value we call universality. I think that's just a really mistaken way to think about literature. It's important to me to identify myself as a queer writer because when I was 14, 15, and 16, the thing that saved my life in Louisville, Kentucky was that I found Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin, and I found Edmund White's A Boy's Own Story. And, you know, those books allowed me to understand that there were worlds in which my life could be seen very differently from how it was seen in Louisville, Kentucky. And, you know, and certainly I think a tradition is just writers having a conversation with each other across time. And there's no question to me that there is an incredibly exciting and vibrant conversation being had among gay writers. And I hope very much that my book enters into that conversation.
As we've heard, it's been called the great gay novel. Now, somebody else who wrote a book that also was called that, who in fact isn't gay, is Hanya Yanagihara, who wrote A Little Life. And in conversation with her, I told her I'd be speaking to you. And she said to me, please ask him, what is gay literature?
So, I mean, I suspect that probably any writer who feels invested in something called gay literature would have a different definition. To me, as a gay writer writing at this historical moment, I mean, because I think we're at a remarkable moment for queer people, and especially as someone coming from the United States, just this last summer, queer people got an extraordinary set of rights and responsibilities with marriage equality. I think marriage equality is important, and I think it's important that the battle was fought and that we won it. I also think it came at a really great cost, which is a kind of packaging of queer lives so that queer lives are given a value that can be understood by people who are disgusted by queer lives. And that has meant a kind of mainstreaming that has really homogenized queer life and presented a single model as a sort of valid model of queer life. I think what's important at this moment for me as a queer writer is not to do that, is to tell stories about people and communities who have been kind of pushed out of that narrative, and to tell those stories in a way that, I mean, I hope that this is a book by a queer writer about queer lives written for queer people, in the sense that I'm not interested in trying to prove the validity or the value of those lives to people who don't accept that. You know, I want this book to be centered on queer lives in a way that doesn't have to translate their value into some other model of life.
In the book, you say that disease was the only story anyone ever told about men like me where I was from. And that's AIDS, of course. And that was a big punctuation point in gay literature. And in a way, as you say, it was the only thing people wrote about. We've moved on.
I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things that I think is so brilliant about Hanya Yanagihara's book, A Little Life, which I've argued it makes sense to think of that book as a great gay novel. And one of the things that I think is remarkable about that book is that it manages to tell a different kind of story of gay life, but in a way that allows the book to address these great traumas of the history of queerness in the 20th century, you know, and one of those is AIDS. And she finds a way to address the kind of grief and mourning and the communities of care that formed around AIDS in a way that isn't bound by the kinds of AIDS narratives that we're used to. It's one of the reasons I think it's such a brilliant book.
Mm. Your book definitely gives us something new in the canon of gay literature, but in a way, actually, it's a very old-fashioned subject. It's the comparatively rich white man and the impoverished native in a poor country. It's a long-standing modern narrative from Graham Greene onwards. And I wonder where you think it fits in that tradition.
Yeah, I certainly did think of it as being, as I say, as entering into a conversation that's long-standing and as having, you know, a lot of kind of partners in that conversation. I mean, I guess I hope that it is written as a kind of reflection of the place we are now. I mean, the narrator of my novel is out. If shame is sort of one of his motivating impulses, as I think it is, it isn't the kind of shame that I think we're used to from older kinds of gay narratives. He has a background in activism. You know, I mean, he has a different culture from, you know, that kind of old-fashioned narrative of white Westerners going abroad in order to sort of have their gay lives, you know, like Houseman did or something. And then I guess I would say, on the other hand, I hope that this is not a book about tourism, because the narrator of this book isn't a tourist. I mean, he's someone who goes to a place and makes a real investment in it in terms of his, you know, kind of his heart. I mean, he goes to this place and he falls in love with it. And he falls in love with the language, and he falls in love with the people he meets there, and he falls in love with the landscape. And I think he's implicated in that country in a way that, you know, in a lot of that tourist literature, I don't know if that's the case. Mm. And in some sense, I mean, the real kind of question of this novel, or the question of the narrator's journey in this novel, is precisely the question of to what extent is he going to bind his destiny to this place and to this man? And, you know, that's the that in some sense forces him to confront, you know, the limits of his own empathy and the limits of his ability to love.
Yeah. Now, it grew out of a novella.
That's right, it did. And it grew out of a novella that was the first piece of fiction I had ever written, because, you know, I had only been a poet until I moved to Bulgaria. And in some way that I don't understand, but that was part of how that place certainly changed my life, was that I started hearing language that I knew was not broken into lines. But at no point in writing this book did I have a sense of what I was doing in any holistic way. I mean, I really wrote it sentence by sentence. And when I finished that first section of the novel, which, you know, kind of does have a complete arc in terms of telling the story of this relationship, I thought it was done. And I didn't really understand that it wasn't done until I was halfway through writing what would become the second section.
Mm. So just for people who haven't read it, just briefly tell us, it's in three sections.
That's right. It's in three sections. And the first and the third section tell a relatively linear narrative of the relationship between an American high school teacher living in Sofia, Bulgaria, and a younger Bulgarian man whom he meets in a public bathroom beneath Sofia's National Palace of Culture and pays for sex. And the story of those two parts is how what at first seems like a very kind of clean transaction, I mean, nothing could be clearer than I give you this, you give me that, actually, because it is an encounter between two human beings, proves kind of infinitely messy. And he finds himself really caught by this man. And then in between those two sections, there's a middle section which explores the narrator's own childhood and his adolescence as a gay kid in Kentucky.
In choosing to set most of this book in Bulgaria, you present us with a language that never quite tells us everything. And the narrator, whose name we never know, tells us that the whole bent of his nature is towards confession. But we only ever see the world through the prism of his worldview, and he never tells us everything.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that that's a big, either a lie or a misconception on his own part. And one of the things I realized when I understood the relationship between the second section about the narrator's childhood and the first section, I realized that when I understood that connection, I realized that what that second section was doing was actually trying to figure out how someone becomes this way, because I think the narrator is a very peculiar guy. And there is a way in which he so clearly longs for this kind of intimacy and connection, and does, you know, claim to, and I think maybe try to confess, you know, sort of narrate himself in a way that could forge that connection. But in fact, he holds himself at a very great remove and, you know, to a very large extent is unavailable to other people, and I think unavailable to himself.
Because of shame?
Well, I mean, I think he, you know, that middle section in exploring kind of two major relationships from his childhood and adolescence, his relationship with his father and his relationship with his best friend who becomes his first beloved. I think we see how the narrator was taught a certain lesson about love and about desire, and was taught in some way to associate the fulfillment of desire with the pain of exclusion. And that, you know, his relationship with Mitko seems to promise kind of that precise dynamic, the fulfillment of desire, but a kind of exclusion structurally, like within the structure of the sex work transaction. But in fact, I think it becomes more complicated than that. And that relationship with Mitko, this younger Bulgarian man, ends up really kind of threatening the narrator's sense of himself, as I think love always does.
Because at the beginning, you think that he's going to find this, the transactional nature of it really freeing, but he doesn't. And Mitko will not allow him to be generous. He has to give him something back, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think that that's really true. I mean, because, you know, like all relationships, I mean, this relationship never escapes the dynamics of power. And so I think it's really hard to say anything adequately complicated and true about the very complex thing that is sex work, especially sex work among men. From one perspective, it is clear that the balance of power is with the person who has the money. On the other hand, the balance of power in this relationship is with the person who has that which is desired, with the person who has the greater access to violence, as Mitko does. I mean, it's just to say it's an incredibly complex relationship between the two of them in terms of how desire and power and various kinds of privilege work. But through it all, the narrator has this extraordinary privilege, which I realized only in living in Bulgaria is the great privilege of being an American, which is that he can leave. And finally, he does get to choose whether or not he's going to bind his destiny to this place, which is the poorest country in the EU. And Mitko doesn't get to make that choice.
Yeah. You talk about desire, and in the book you point out that desire becomes ridiculous the moment it isn't welcomed.
Yeah, you know, and that I think that position of being ridiculous is something that this narrator understands really well. And I think it's something that is sort of part of coming of age for almost all queer people. You know, I mean, one of the things about being a queer kid, I mean, one of the things that people who work with queer kids quickly understand is that being queer is not like being other minorities, because you are born without a community. You aren't born into a queer family. You aren't born into an environment. I mean, maybe this is changing now, but certainly until very recently, you had very little chance of being born into an environment that might model for you what a sort of bearable life looks like. And so, you know, I think that that feeling of desire carrying with it a kind of prohibition is something that I think a lot of queer people grow up with.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the structure of the book now. As we know, it's in three parts, but the middle section is basically one long paragraph. It feels to me like one great big scream of pain. Was it written in one go?
It was a writing experience unlike any I had had before. I mean, as I say, I finished the first section, Mitko, and thought that the story was completed. I thought I would write something else. I thought I might write some poems. And I really found myself one day as I was walking around this very peculiar landscape that is Mladost in Sofia, Bulgaria, which is this landscape of kind of decaying socialist era apartment blocks and then, you know, half finished, very cheap construction that has popped up everywhere in this kind of unregulated capitalism that followed socialism. I was walking around on a very hot day and I found myself just seized by a voice. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. It's an experience unlike any other I've had as a writer. And I went into a cafe in Mladost and I started writing on receipts and on napkins. It was like I had to write it on trash. And I wrote it very quickly in a white heat and then found that I couldn't look at it for more than a year. I mean, it was such a wrenching, because it does explore the landscape of my childhood. And it was such a wrenching experience. I had to put it, when I tried to look at it, I would feel physically sick for more than a year. And it's cast as a single paragraph, which, you know, somehow didn't feel like something I chose, but did feel like the only possible form it could take.
And the way that you're walking through this landscape and the way that your language relates to both that and the childhood of the narrator, in the way that he gets mired in the mud of the landscape and, of course, in the mud of his past too. It's so poetic.
You know, I think that there is a way that, I mean, as I say, the strangest thing about being in Bulgaria was the frequency with which I found myself reminded of Kentucky. even though they're very different places in a lot of ways. And I found that, you know, in Bulgaria, I was able to think about my childhood in a way that I hadn't. I mean, I've spent most of my life running away from you know, I felt like I fled Kentucky when I was 16. I've spent most of my life running away from the memory of it. And maybe it was just that Bulgaria was far enough away that it sort of became possible for me to think about experiences I had as a child. But also, I think it was, I mean, one, you know, meeting queer people in Bulgaria who told the same kinds of stories and the same had the same kind of sense of a horizon of possibility in their lives as the first gay men I met when I was a kid in Kentucky. But, and then also, I think there is a kind of similarity of geography, like the mountains are similar size and the forests have similar kinds of trees. I mean, I did really think, you know, when you driving from Sofia to the Black Sea felt a lot like driving through Kentucky. And there was a way that that landscape, which again is so strange, so different from anything we have in America, somehow became overlaid on top of the landscape of my childhood.
We're making this book sound quite bleak, but there are some amazing descriptions of love, even when it's very painful. So, for instance, the relationship with Kay, you give a description of perfect harmony. You say, "I introduced him to my solitude and he deepened it without disturbance."
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the, there are these moments in the book, and I, you know, I do think it's a sad book, but I don't think it's a book without consolation. And, you know, much of that consolation comes in these moments, either remembered or observed, or in at least one case, experienced in present time by the narrator. Experiences of what seems to him like a kind of balanced and reciprocal love. And they're very often experiences associated with or experienced in childhood. Mm. So he often, and I, you know, I didn't understand this until I had finished the book. You know, it was, wasn't something I was aware of as I was writing. But he has a way of looking at children with their parents and sort of projecting onto it a kind of harmony that he feels like he remembers, even as he doubts it. He feels like he remembers having had with his father when he was very young. And so I think there is a vision of, even though this is a book about solitude in many ways and about various kinds of alienation, I think it's a book that has at its heart a sort of vision of and faith in human connection.
And just picking up on the talk of children in the novel, there's an intimacy confident of absolute possession that you describe, and that's the man playing with his daughter by the river. And you say that how that physical relationship becomes impossible as the child grows, how eventually that becomes the loss that we seek the rest of our lives to restore.
Right, and I think, you know, I guess I do think that's true. And I think that that is something that's not particular to the queer experience. I mean, I think that is something that all of us undergo. It's kind of a necessary part of becoming a human being. Mm. You know, I do think that as childhood, very young childhood, you know, before it has occurred to us to question if we've been lucky and if we've been parented in a certain way, before it occurs to us to question the durability of our bond with our parents, you know, that is the one time in our lives where we can be absolutely certain of what belongs to us.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about making poems as a way of loving things. And then a little bit later, you a really thought-provoking insight on love when you write that it isn't just a matter of looking at someone, but also of looking with them, facing what they face.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's this old line from a 17th century French philosopher, Malebranche, that poets really love. And it says, "Attention is the natural prayer of the soul." And I do think it's true. Iris Murdoch also wrote along these lines where she would say, you know, love is a matter of attention and sort of love is a way of looking. And if you look at something sort of with all of your moral faculties at work, that's kind of, that's the best definition of love we have. And for a long time, I was really convinced by that. And I think my narrator is convinced by that too. And he does think, you know, he has a way of looking at the world that he thinks is a way of loving it and of looking at it and turning it into art. And one of the things he comes to question precisely through this relationship he has with Mitko is that faith in looking and art making as an adequate response to the world. And he comes to think that, no, actually, what it means to stand in an ethical relationship to someone else is to take on their fate. And, you know, that becomes the big question of the sort of later movements of this book, the extent to which he has the capacity to do that, not just with Mitko, but maybe with anyone.
When considering one's obligation to others.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And what is the answer then?
I mean, I don't know what the answer is, you know. I mean, I think we do the best we can with the faculties we have. I do hope that the narrator undergoes a journey by which, even as he understands the limits of his own empathy and of his ethical response, that empathy and that ethical response are deepened. I hope that that's true. But, you know, I think love is a challenge or a test that all of us fail. And what can you do except continue to strive for it?
And insofar as your narrator reflects certain aspects of your own life and the way that your family has been fractured, perhaps through your sexuality, I noticed in the acknowledgements of the book, you mentioned a couple of people and said that they were the family that you've created.
Yes, which I think is something, you know, Edmund White has written really gorgeously about the kinds of families that queer people create for themselves. And, you know, I think that's one model of life that queer community can offer. Because it's true that even as, you know, in my own case, my family, or at least my relationship to my family, really was fractured by coming out. You know, there is a kind of investment in friendship that queer people make precisely because of that loss. That is sustaining of communities and of lives.
I have a feeling that your family is about to get a whole lot bigger. Huge amount of fans, I'm quite sure,
for
this fantastic book, What Belongs to You, by Garth Greenwell. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me.
What Belongs to You by Garth Greenwell is published by Picador. It's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.